KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Ross Reynolds in the studio with Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize winning economist, and our studio audience. Say, studio audience, who's your favorite economist?
Paul Krugman!
Whoa, they all...
There we go. That's better.
We rehearsed this, and I heard some Adam Smiths, but they all went to your side after that. That's kind of amazing. I wanted to get back to this your big idea in this book, which is that the federal government really needs to put money into the economy in order to bring us out of this depression. And does that translate to the state level? In our state, there was discuss of borrowing for a program to create jobs. Does it make sense at the state level?
Very limited. For one thing, there are constitutional limits in most states to deficit financing. But also a state is state spends money. A lot of it spills over to other states, so it doesn't work the same way as with the federal government. There's just a lot less room for maneuver. And, of course, states don't have their own currency. It matters a great deal. One of the reasons that the U.S. government is pretty much immune from anything like what's happening to Greece is that we do actually borrow in our own currency. The state of Washington is more like Greece, which borrows in someone else's currency, the euro, the dollar. So, no, there's only so much. There's a little bit of wiggle room at the level of states, but not a lot. This has to be a national policy.
So if you're a state lawmaker and a bill is being proposed for $1 billion that will be borrowed and bonded to pay for these things, how do you look at that? How do you decide whether that's the right way to do it?
If it's valuable infrastructure, yes. I mean, this is actually a very good time for infrastructure spending. Interest rates are low. The workers that you'll employ are workers who would otherwise be unemployed. That's why actually I'm so angry at my governor. Governor yells at people of New Jersey who canceled the most important, you know, current infrastructure project in America, which is that second rail tunnel under the Hudson, for no good reason. He could have afforded it. The bonds could have been issued. Much of the money was coming from the federal government. So things like that, where there is some wiggle room, you should use it. But it is limited.
Like it or not, both Republicans and Democrats talk a lot about the deficit and how we're going to deal with the deficit. It's kind of the conversation is turned there rather than to spending programs of the sort that you suggest. And one of the things they'll bring up is we're just leaving this huge debt burden for future generations.
Okay. First of all, if we're really worried about future generations, how about all of those recent college graduates who can't find jobs? And we actually have a lot of evidence on how long will their careers, how long will their income suffer from the fact that they graduated into a lousy labor market? And the answer is forever. They will never recover. That we know that from past recessions. So if you really care about the future generations, how about providing an environment in which today's graduates can actually find jobs? How about providing infrastructure so that the next generation isn't going to be dealing with crumbling bridges and roads? And then if you actually try to work through the arithmetic, Does austerity policies, does slashing spending now, does it even help the future budget? And the answer almost certainly is not, because it depresses the economy now, which means lower revenue. So a lot of what you save by slashing spending, you end up losing through lower tax receipts. Plus, it damages the economy in the long run. There's a lot of evidence that a depressed economy doesn't just hurt you now. It actually cuts into your future capacity. Those workers, we have 4 million Americans who've been out of work for more than a year. Many of them will never find jobs again. The longer that goes on, the more of them will never find jobs again. Those students will never be in get their careers back on track. Those are the future taxpayers of America. So even in a purely debt fiscal sense, it is disastrous to be doing this kind of austerity now. We have become like medieval doctors who treated patients. They thought that the way to treat a sick guy was to bleed him. And after the bloodletting, the guy would get sicker, and they said, well, we need to bleed him even more. And our deficit obsession right now is the same kind of thing. We're saying deficits, well, we have to cut, and then the deficits don't improve because the economy shrinks, so we need to cut even more.
There's the deficits, but part of the big drivers in the federal government are the defense budget and the entitlements budget. And how are we going to be able to support programs like Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security with fewer people working and more people drawing on those funds?
Yeah, there is a long-run budget problem. By all means, let's think about that. It has less to do, by the way, with demography than people think. The aging population is there, but we've already made some provisions for that. I mean, retirement age on Social Security has already gone up to 66 and will go to 67, and I think should go no higher for a lot of reasons. Healthcare costs. We need a serious effort to control healthcare costs, which starts with saying Medicare is going to look at what actually works in terms of medical treatments and pay for the ones that work and not for the ones that don't. And of course, it's the very same people who are screaming about deficits who start yelling death panels at any suggestion that we actually spend Medicare money wisely.
You're a real optimist about Keynesian economics being the solution to our problems, but it sounds like you're a bit of a pessimist when it comes to the political will to get that done.
Well, it's really, yeah. I mean, so I have an analogy. There's a great John Maynard Keynes, who got a lot of this stuff right. He wrote back in 1930, as the Great Depression was gathering strength, he said, we have magneto trouble with the electrical system of the car. So it's a big car, it's got all kinds of stuff, but it's actually a fairly small thing that you could fix. It's like having a dead battery. And the way analogy I actually use in this depression now in the book is I say, so suppose that you have a car which is actually in great shape except has a dead battery, and all you need to do is replace that dead battery, but your husband refuses to believe that it's a dead battery and refuses to admit that he was wrong in saying that it wasn't the dead battery, and insists that instead of replacing the battery, you have to learn to walk and take buses. Well, you have a problem. You have maybe a serious problem, maybe even an insoluble problem, but the problem is not with the car. And that's essentially where we are in our political situation right now.
Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman is my guest. The new book is called End This Depression Now. We count on guys and women like you, the economists, to tell us what's going on and what will work and what won't work. You write in your book, The Politicization and Corruption Overtaking the Economics Profession. Could you explain a little bit more about that?
So, I mean, economics, it's always going to be political. There's so much politics involved in it. It's so relevant to political matters that people will have views, and no doubt that will color their research and so on. But what has happened to my profession is really bad. An awful lot of people seem to have – it's a couple of things. One is they got attracted to models, beautiful economic models that said that markets always work perfectly, according to which, of course, the depression we're living through couldn't possibly happen. And given the reality that it is happening, instead of saying, well, maybe my model was wrong, they're just digging in and saying, well, it must be – somehow it must be Obama's fault, right? And then there's an awful lot of people who may be less rigid in their ideas but who are, as some of us now say, playing for Team Republican. And that's been sad. You know, I'm sure – you know, of course, people will accuse me of doing the same thing, but I think I try to test my ideas, try to say, am I saying this because I really believe it, or am I saying it because it's politically convenient? And no doubt, sometimes I fail, but it's just painfully obvious that a lot of economists are not doing that. They're just going with what is politically convenient, and they are abdicating their responsibility, which is to make the best faith effort they can to get this right.
You know, economists talk constantly about the need for growth. But how does economic growth go with the idea that we need to have a sustainable economy? Can you keep growing and be sustainable?
Yes. It's the matters what kind of growth. So GDP is not measured by the amount of stuff, certainly not measured by the amount of carbon dioxide we emit. GDP is measured by the value of things to us. And what we need is the right incentives. We need taxes on carbon or cap and trade, which puts a price. You need things that give people an incentive not to do environmentally destructive things. And then we can continue to have lots of economic growth, but it has to be the right kind of growth, which is not hard. That's basic economics. Again, it's not hard economically. It's very hard politically.
I have to ask you, a couple of years ago, you played a cameo role in the film Get Him to the Greek. Jonah Hill sees you and he says, my dad loves your stuff, we'll say, because
yes,
we can't say
right.
The real thing. The Dallas Morning News hollered, welcome to your comedy career. The New York Times said your appearance jolted that movie back to life. But it looks like your comedy career has not progressed. What's wrong?
Yeah, unfortunately, I was just my wife persuaded me to stick with this economist thing for a little while. The Borscht Belt will come later.
Okay. Although, as you can hear, a pretty entertaining talker, too. Paul Krugman, you're clearly a smart guy. You're a very confident guy. What are the things about the economy that are still big mysteries to you that you wrestle with?
Oh, wow. That rise in inequality, we only understand it partly. That takeoff of the top 1% and even more, the top 0.01%, is still at least partly mysterious. Economic growth. Why do some countries do much better at long-term growth than others? That's an underlying mystery. My old teacher, Bob Solow, said that every attempt to explain why countries do so differently always ends up in a blaze of amateur sociology, which for an economist is a great insult, right? So, no, there's lots of things. I mean, if you ask the question, why isn't Mexico doing better? You know, they've done a lot of reforms, and I have some notions of why, but So there's lots of things I don't understand, but this, ending this depression now, that I understand.
Good. You got the book name in again.
There we are.
Paul Krugman, winner of the Nobel Prize, End This Depression Now, is the new book. Thank you so much for coming by. I appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Well, if you want to get a job, where you are is extremely important, according to Enrico Moretti, professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. His work has been featured in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere. Enrico, you start this book with the tale of two California cities, Menlo Park and Visalia. They're only about 3 hours away by car, but they couldn't be more different. How? And how do they illustrate your thesis?
That's right. It's the story of an engineer named David Breedlove, who was trying to decide between these two cities in 1969. And at the time, these two cities were roughly the same. They had similar wages, similar industry composition, similar type of employers. One is Menlo Park in the middle of Silicon Valley, and the other one is a small town in rural California. And like many professionals at the time, David Breedlove was attracted by a quiet life, safer schools, and less pollution that rural communities seemed to promise. So eventually he sold his house in Silicon Valley and moved to this rural community. Now, if you look at these two communities now, 30 years later, they're very different, but not in the way that David Breedlove and many professionals who made that choice envisioned. Today, Menlo Park is at the heart of one of the most successful innovation cluster in the world. It has some of the highest wages in America, one of the best educated community. It has low crime, low pollution, and within California, some of the better schools. Visalia, on the contrary, has completely lagged behind. Because it didn't have all that many college-educated workers in the 60s and the 70s, it missed out completely on the growth of high-tech. Now, its wages are among the lowest in the nation. Crime is twice as high. The quality of the schools is terrible. And every other aspect of private and social life there seems to be so much different from Menlo Park. And the reason I'm telling these stories is that I think it perfectly exemplifies what has been happening to many of our communities in the past 30 years. You know, if you look at America today, you don't see just one country. There are basically three increasingly different countries. On one end, there are cities like the area around Menlo Park, Silicon Valley and San Francisco, that have developed a very strong innovation-based economy, and they have a labor force that is one of the most creative and best paid in the country. At the other extremes, there are cities that are in much worse conditions, Detroit, Flint, mm-hmm. Cleveland, and Visalia, which have been losing population, and I mean, they're shedding jobs by the thousands. And in the middle, there is the rest of the country, which seems undecided on which direction to go.
Now, you say that these areas developed this innovation economy. But let's face it, if Bill Gates' father didn't come from Seattle, if he hadn't moved here in large part for those family connections, it might have gone a whole different direction, couldn't it?
That's right. A great story, what I think is a great story in the book, is the story of Seattle, because it's one of the wonderful success stories of American cities. Seattle in the 70s, it was a very different community. Boeing was struggling, Packard was struggling, and the city was shedding jobs by the thousands. I'm sure many of your listeners remember when a sign went up on 5 that says, "The last who lives Seattle, please turn the lights off."
Yeah.
And I think that sign perfectly exemplifies the mood of a community in decline. But then something happened in January 1979. And what happened was that a small firm that was located in Albuquerque, New Mexico, decided to relocate to Seattle. And that small firm was called Microsoft. And he moved here because its founders, both Allen and Gates, wanted to be close to their families. And that was the starting point of the high-tech cluster in this community.
So the solution to having a creative community is have the family of people who are going to be like Bill Gates or Paul Allen, and then so they want to move back to your town? I mean, it doesn't give much guidance.
That's right. But I think what's really interesting is how Seattle changed the local economy. Because, okay, sure. I'm sorry, how Microsoft changed the local economy. Microsoft has 40,000 employees. That sounds a lot. But, you know, in a metro area of 2 million people, when you include the entire Puget Sound area, that's not a lot. So I think what's really interesting and instructive is to understand how that one company reshaped the entire community.
And one of your core points here is that it wasn't just good for people who were working at Microsoft. There's this kind of knock-on effect in other areas of employment too, right?
That's right. I think that's the most important and possibly the most surprising part of the story. Every time a community is able to attract an high-tech employer, it gains not just the jobs within that employer, but it gains many more jobs outside high-tech in the local service sector. I call this the multiplier effect, and this multiplier effect is surprisingly large. I estimate that for each job in high-tech, 5 additional jobs are supported outside high-tech in positions, some of which require not many skills, like taxi drivers and waiters and hairdressers, but some do require a good education, like lawyers and doctors and nurses and teachers. Take Microsoft, for example. It has 40,000 employees in the Puget Sound areas, but indirectly supports 200,000 additional jobs in the local service sector. So remarkably, if you think about it, the main effect that Microsoft has on the Puget Sound regional economy is not in the high-tech sector. It's actually outside the high-tech sector.
We're talking,
and that's why it matters for all of us, not just for the
for the
techies.
Now, wasn't the world supposed to be getting flatter with all this technology? You could live anywhere you wanted to and participate in the knowledge economy, and geography was supposed to become less important. You're saying quite the opposite.
Yes, pundits and experts have been arguing that the world is flat. You know, Thomas Friedman wrote one of the most successful and influential books about globalization of the past 2 decades. Arguing exactly that geography doesn't matter anymore, that somebody in Bangalore with a Skype or a cell phone or email can have exactly same access to information, to contacts, to coworkers than somebody sitting in Seattle or San Francisco. And the prediction of that view of the world is that the great innovation hubs of America, again, like Silicon Valley, Seattle, or Austin, should be declining because they have high cost of living, they have traffic jams, and you don't need to be here. You can just sit wherever you want. You can be in the middle of the Colorado Mountains.
Well, and communication's gotten better since Thomas Friedman promulgated that idea, so it's not as though he was wrong about us being able to connect. In fact, we can connect in ways he never quite imagined back then. So what was the missing element?
The missing element is that, contrary to his predictions, the attractive power of this innovation cluster has not diminished. In fact, it has increased. You see more and more of innovation jobs concentrated in America's great innovation hubs. You see more and more venture capitals being invested there. You see more and more R&D expenditures being spent there. And the reason is that in innovation, really face-to-face contact still matters. Our best ideas are never born in isolation. Our best ideas are always born from some serendipitous interaction with somebody that we bump into at a water cooler, at a local pub. We can communicate easily with every corner of the world, but at the same time, where we live matter more and more. And I think this is one of the great paradoxes of our times. We live in a world that is increasingly interconnected and globalized, and at the same time, it's increasingly localized, where the person that we meet and the ideas that we get exposed to matter more and more.
Finally, you wrote, your salary depends more on where you live than on your resume. What do you have to say to the young graduates from the University of Washington and elsewhere about how that should influence whether they stay here or go somewhere else?
Well, the key predictor of a community economic success is the number of college graduates in a community. So if I was a recent college graduate today and was looking around where to live, the most important thing that I would look at is how many college graduates are there in this community, because in the next 10 or 20 years, that's where the creative, innovative employers will locate, and that's where all the jobs for people with skills and a good education will open up.
Incidentally, or perhaps not, that's also the key predictor for a successful public radio station. So I don't know what that means. Enrico Moretti, the new book is called The New Geography of Jobs. Thank you so much for stopping by and telling us about it.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.